Yes, this is Sunset Boulevard, Los Angeles, California. It's about 5 o'clock in the morning. That's the homicide squad, complete with detectives and newspapermen. A murder has been reported from one of those great big houses in the 10,000 block. You'll read about it in the late editions, I'm sure.
I have...
Current geek!
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Current Geeks Film Festival, a special monthly look at the greatest movies of all time. From a geeky perspective, I'm Scott Johnson with Tom Merritt. Hello.
The Homicide Squad.
Homicide. I noticed that
they
as well.
They go and they use insecticide on homogenous milk.
Only when people are killed in their homes do we have a homicide.
Homicide Squad. That's what it is. Now I get it.
It was definitely...
I am tempted to use that kind of accent for this entire show.
It's hard not to, especially when we do... So not all the movies on this list of 100 greatest movies that we've sort of amalgamated from various sources, not all of them are in black and white or this old, but when they are in black and white or this old, it's impossible not to sort of get into the groove of the way people talked and looked and sang and... You know, moved around the screen. It's a different time, man. It ain't
the way they talked without moving their lips.
That did happen a lot. And in this case, we'll get to here in a second, but we have an actress whose whole career started in an era where they couldn't hear you. So It was all about emoting and, you know, being very physical about your performance. And now she's being asked to move into a talkie era. She'd done other movies too, but to represent somebody who came up in the silent era, like she actually did, it's a snake eating itself in Sunset Boulevard.
Sunset Boulevard. this movie is one of the early examples of stunt casting, really. I mean, it's more than just that, but, you know, you took a silent film star and cast her as an aging silent film star. You took a silent film director who was no longer really making movies and cast him as a silent film director who was no longer making movies. Like, a lot of people played themselves in this movie.
Yeah.
Even if they're themselves, a lot of people actually played themselves, like Cecil DeMille. And then some people played a version of themselves that had a different name.
Yeah, very different. I actually don't have any other comparative material to say it's all that different, but it feels very groundbreaking in that regard. And everything I could find and read about Sunset Boulevard supported the idea that this was a little bit crazy and meta for a movie to kind of be so self-referential. One of the comparisons that I read was Warner Brothers cartoons used to do this a lot. So you'd see Edward G. Robinson or Bing Crosby or whoever would show up
in these cartoons. Right.
And to us, to you and me, it seems like a relic of a whole different time. So it doesn't really strike us as weird, but it would be like today... But here's Katy Perry walking in with his joke to tell, and then here's another popular whatever. Which
Edward G. Robinson feels like a historical character at this point, right? Even more so than Bing Crosby, because Edward G. Robinson died earlier than Bing Crosby did.
Yeah, that's true.
But at the time, you know, yeah, it would be like, I don't know, Clint Eastwood showing up, right?
Sure.
He's an old guy, but he's still somebody everybody knows.
So for a couple of 80s guys, you know, we didn't know any better. We just thought it was old stuff. But this movie is doing kind of the same thing. It's taking contemporary stuff, in some cases older, you know, that's referencing the silent film era, and that was different than it would be in 1950, obviously. But there were a lot of kind of references to modern day goings on at the Paramount studio, and various people from the silent era make a weird cameo in this thing. And they make something weirdly meta that I don't feel like I've never seen this movie, but I don't feel like this is common. I don't think there were a lot of movies in the 50s that were kind of, you know, that meta or that double layered.
And technically this movie is from the 40s. It was completed in 1949.
Right.
And if you want to be one of those kind of people, you can be like, well, the first year of any decade is actually the last year of the previous. but it is very 40s in its sensibility because it is, August 10th, 1950 is when it was released. So it's very early in the 50s and directed by the great Billy Wilder of The Apartment or Some Like It Hot fame, although very early in his career. Those other two big movies came later, 1959 and 1960.
So what is it, do you think, about this movie, which Billy Wilder says a lot is based on some experiences with people he knew in Hollywood? I don't know if he got more specific than that, but... I don't know if that includes the murder or not, but
no, of course. I don't think the murder is based on, unlike Psycho, I don't think the murder is based on a real murder, although I'm sure nefarious things did happen, and maybe it's pulling from those.
Sure. But what do you think after viewing it again? And you'd seen it before. This is my first viewing. What do you think there is? What is it about the movie, if you could boil it down, that makes it one of the best 100 movies ever made, according to every list I've seen?
Well, and granted, like all of the movies that we watch in Kranking Film Fest, we're not saying this is your top movie. We're not even saying it's our top movie. We're saying this is the consensus among all of the different associations out there that these are the greatest movies. And it's kind of our point here to talk about, well, is it? Do we agree? I agree in this case, because it is the intersection of the hard-boiled detective story, the pinnacle of the film noir era, and a Hollywood gossip story romance. So if you want a film noir movie, there are plenty of better film noir movies. If you want a better hard-boiled detective story, there's better hard-boiled detective story. If you want a greater dramatic romance, there's better dramatic romances, but this has got all of them.
Yeah, it's a weird
and
mashup.
It does it in a way that I think was novel then and still feels novel. That's one of the hard things to get across. Even with things like Casablanca, you look at them and you can appreciate them, but you sort of have to get past that so many films have done homages that it almost feels like a parody of itself. Sunset Boulevard, in some ways, was parodying itself from the minute it started. Norma Desmond is a, larger than life character. She's a parody of the aging actress. I don't think that's changed. And I think that makes it feel a little more relevant now than a movie of its age would normally feel.
I agree. It does stick out in that regard. The only thing I didn't like about the movie, and I think it's on purpose, and I meant to be put off by it, I think. Okay, so this is just interpretation. I think I'm supposed to be put off by it. You may have a different feeling.
All the smoking. Yeah,
not that, but all of Gloria Swanson's performance is so over the top and crazy. Like, she is just so, the cameras, the lights, that whole like overacting thing that is very much the silent film era of acting. Like, that's what you did to convey an emotion, because you couldn't say the words. You had to show how upset somebody was, or how in love they were.
And if you didn't catch what Scott said earlier, Gloria Swanson, who plays Norma Desmond, was a silent film era star.
Right.
Like, the pictures of her that are on the tables and the piano are actual pictures of Gloria Swanson from the silent film era. The silent movie that they show in Sunset Boulevard is an actual movie that she starred in, directed by Max von Strom, who is her servant in this movie. Like, it's all real.
And not only that, she's how do I put this? Like, there are other people in this movie that show up. Buster Keaton has a very small cameo as Buster Keaton.
Yeah.
A few other silent stars pop in here and there. And there are references to Valentino and some other stuff. Rudolph Valentino. She is the real deal, though. Like, I did a bunch of hunting around. This wasn't like she was some... Oh, she was okay during the silent film era.
I messed it up. It's Eric von Stroheim. Max is his name in the movie.
Yeah, Max is the character. It didn't occur to me until you just now said it. But she was the real deal. She was like straight up a big star in the silent era. And what typically happened to those silent movie stars, not all of them, but many of them, some of the comedians made it out a little more, made out better than some, but a lot of their careers just up and died when talkies came around.
Charlie Chaplin, one of the very few to navigate the switch, but didn't navigate it super successfully.
No,
right? He was bigger as a silent star. Buster Keaton obviously was a big influence on Charlie Chaplin. Mm-hmm. He's someone we know his name, but it's from silent films. And the other two that you're mentioning from her Bridge Club were Anna Q. Nelson and H.B. Warner, big silent stars as well, but names you probably don't recognize.
Yeah, and that's impressive to me that they figured out a way to take her from... I mean, I don't know if it felt this way then, but it sure felt to me like, oh man, she probably went through a lot of this stuff that she's feeling. Like, she's gone through the we were the thing and now we are kind of deprecated to this older form of entertainment because the new hotness is here. And so nobody cares about us anymore. And that's maybe why the character works so well. She just rolled that stuff into who she was playing. It was impressive. She was nominated for an Oscar for this role. I think probably deservedly so by 1950s standards. I think she did a really, really good job. Actually, everybody in this thing was nominated for something. They only won three total awards. Let me find those here. Critical reception. Oh, yeah, here it is. They were nominated for Best Picture, Best Director, Best Actor, Actress, Supporting Actor and Actress, Best Writing and Screenplays, where they won their first one. Those others they were nominated didn't win. Best Art Direction and Set Direction in a black and white film. They won. I guess they separated them, black and white, because there was some early color. But anyway, and then Best Music Score for a Dramatic or Comedy Picture. They won that. So they won a few things, but they were nominated for everything. Cinematography, Best Picture, Actors, all that stuff. And I don't know, once in a while, this kind of stuff surprises me. I always expect to be like, I don't know if this holds up. This is old and cheesy. And there are moments in it where you're like, okay, that trope is beaten to death by now. This held up way better than I expected going into it. In fact, I think I'm having the opposite experience you had with our recent episode about Lost. You were saying, I thought I'd get back into Lost and immediately the magic would come back. And it didn't as much for you. It didn't live up to what it used to be for you as much. I'm kind of having the reverse here. I went in here thinking, all right, Sunset Boulevard, let's see what you got. And I came out going, oh, that was actually pretty good. I would recommend that to people. Yeah. If they said,
interesting. Yeah. I wasn't sure if you would like this one or not. And I hadn't watched it since VHS. Mm-hmm. Like the first time I ever saw it was a videotape that I rented. Maybe I took it home from work because I worked at a used bookstore that sold videotapes. But I definitely remember watching it on a tiny television in VHS. And I remember it as being a little fuzzy. Mm-hmm. And watching it on a big HD TV really brought out a lot of the cinematography that I don't think I appreciated the first time I saw it. I mean, this is a masterful blend of the brightness of LA when he's outside, mm-hmm. right? And the darkness of film noir when he's inside. And I think that's one of the things Billy Wilder was trying to do, was show off how the world of Los Angeles seems bright and sunny and fun, but there's this dark underbelly caused by these silent film stars who made bank. They're doing fine, mm-hmm. but then they got left behind, and the right. money isn't enough.
No, the fame is what matters. I didn't know the famous line, "I'm ready for my close-up, Mr. DeMille." I didn't know that was from this movie. In fact, I have it right here. Let me play it. It's you've all heard this in some context, but maybe a bunch of you were like me and you didn't know what it was from, but this was it.
All right, Mr. DeMille, I'm ready for my close-up.
She also says it differently than I have in my head, because everything I've ever seen is...
Well, it's one of those, right? Yeah. It's, all right, Mr. DeMille, I'm ready for my close-up. And it's always quoted as, I'm ready for my close-up, Mr. DeMille.
Yeah.
And we were talking about this on the DTNS post-show today. Like, there are so many of those kinds of lines out there. Like, play it again, Sam. We talked about this with Casablanca, too. Mm-hmm. He doesn't ever say, play it again, Sam. He says, play it, Sam. You played it for her. You can play it for me. So... It's funny how those work and how you almost can't, it almost seems like she's saying it wrong when she says it.
Yeah. It caught me off guard because, the way she says it is a little bit less pronounced. Like everything I've ever heard where that's been repeated, kind of like the one we always get wrong from Empire Strikes Back about Luke, I am your father, that whole thing. When you actually see it, it's a little less dramatically delivered by her, and everything I've seen has been like a cartoon or something making fun of it or some kind of parody. And the person's always, I'm ready for my close-up, Mr. DeMille. And they just do it in this like overt, like in-your-face kind of way. It wasn't really like that in the movie. So I'm surprised, I guess, that it was so, I don't know, famous. That line, I mean, that line's, I still hear people use that line.
Yeah. Like, it's interesting. It makes you wonder why certain lines... I mean, this thing is 68 years old now. Like, why did that line continue to last? Where there are other lines that I remember. I can't think of a good example now off the top of my head, unfortunately. But there are lines I remember people quoting all the time when I was growing up in the 70s. Nobody says those anymore, you know. But, yeah. I'm trying. You know, funny. I want to say there's a line by Mae West that's out there, and I can't think of it either, but Mae West was originally considered for this role. Greta Garbo was considered this role. According to Wikipedia, the silent film store Norma Shearer turned down the role because she found it distasteful.
Oh.
And a lot of critics thought this was too harsh on Hollywood. It feels like there's been so many harsher things about Hollywood since that this is almost lightweight. But you got to remember, like, it's got a murder. Like, I forget, like, it straight up starts with a murder.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and a little backwards story. And it's also got a bit of a twist because you don't know right away that the narrator is William Holden, and that's the guy who's floating in the pool. So you don't know that right away. You do kind of figure that out pretty early. But now you're on this now well-worn tropey path of, we got to figure out how we got there. And that's the oldest trick in the book now. Flashback and say, all right, well, before the death, what led up to it? And I really enjoyed that journey. I didn't know how that was going to end. And I didn't expect to kind of feel for the guy the way I ended up feeling for him. I mean, his actual death was kind of cheeseball and dumb, but that's Hollywood in 1949. Like, nobody.
Oh, you mean the staggering, like, yeah, the whole, I've been shot. I've been spun around and shot. Now I've been shot again. Yeah. I'm going to fall in the pool. Yeah,
no blood, just kind of, you know, lay there. And that's fine. I don't have a problem with those things. I see those for the things that they are for the time that they're from. But like Citizen Kane, I do get the sense that it's subversive for its time. And I don't know why I even have that sense. I don't feel like I should have a sense for that. Or when I was younger, I feel like I'd see these movies and just go, all right, well, they're trying to tell a story. Everyone acted like they were on stage back then. It's kind of annoying. Anyway, good thing we have new movies, right? Like, that was kind of my attitude. In this, you get the sense that this would have been not Hollywood's favorite look in the mirror, you know, like, that's supposed to be this glitzy, shiny world of stars. And really, there's some underbelly, and they're showing some underbelly here. And this may be completely fictitious underbelly. I don't know. Like you said, Billy Wilder says he based it on a lot of reality, but.
Yeah, I mean, Gloria Swanson lived on Sunset Boulevard in an Italianate palace. She used to get 10,000 fan letters at a time. So it's, you know, there's some reality to this story, even for Gloria Swanson, even if he claims he didn't base it on any one person.
Yeah.
And he certainly was writing it. He started writing the story before she was on board. But one of the things that I noticed is that they apparently submitted the script to the censors a page at a time in order to slip some of these nuances by that otherwise they might have been called on, because the Breen Code was really strict. You could not show. I mean, they don't have Holden's character in the same room as Gloria Swanson, right? They've got separate bedrooms, which also is kind of a luxury feature, right?
Sure.
You see that like in The Crown. Prince Philip and Queen Elizabeth have separate bedrooms. It's a luxuriousness. So you kind of hide it at that, but he never goes into her room except to hang up that phone.
Yeah.
Like, you know, and there's a motivation for that. That's non-sexy. So they have to really navigate around, and yet you definitely know what's going on. You know what's happening off screen.
Oh, sure. Yeah. To see him be controlled like this, or maybe not control, but submit himself to this weird, obsessive person, and kind of know as he's getting into it that the closer he gets to her, the worse it's going to be if he needs to separate himself.
Yeah.
Is really interesting. And it made me think of more modern tales of a similar ilk, like the one, I can never remember the name of it, but the one with, it was big in the 80s. She killed a rabbit.
Oh, that one. Schindler's List. No, not that one.
No, the one that with was the, was she, what's
with
his name?
Guy.
Michael Douglas is having an affair with, I can't think of her name. Cruella
Pretty
DeVille.
Michael Douglas falling down.
None of this is right. But someone in the chat will probably bark it out and I'm an idiot. But these kinds of movies are, you know, Hand That Rocks the Cradle, there's one.
There we go.
This idea of somebody scorned who goes on to do something hideous because they were, you know, pushed aside by somebody, or their obsession led to horrible things. Like, that story's been told a billion times, but I'm noticing a pattern with our top 100 movies so far, and the pattern is subversion. Even these old ones where it's a more tightly controlled sort of Hollywood system, this, Citizen Kane, and others, Casablanca, even, they have these subtle, like, I don't know, like, they're not afraid to look at the darker side of what they're trying to tell. They're not, it's not just a big pretty bow on everything. Psycho is another great example of this. It's like they're subverting the time that they're in, and even more of the modern examples like the Godfather, that I think subverts it in its time as well. In lots of ways, where it's like pushing the
mafia,
the limits.
The mafia was not a thing people talked about. The mafia was sometimes a thing people dismissed as something that wasn't real. That doesn't really happen, right? Unless you had direct experience with it.
Sure.
So I you know, The Godfather was sort of, and Mario Puzo's book in particular was groundbreaking because it painted it in all of its reality as like, no, this is not only real, but these are the motivations. This is what causes people to do this. This isn't cardboard cutout characters like James Cagney. This is, they're real. And that was a subversion of a kind. You're right.
And we have a million of those today that are movies that don't subvert anything. They just sort of follow the lines. They might pick up on a cool a trope that's going on. Like the Fast and the Furious movies are fun and great and a good time, but they're not really subverting anything. They're not really talking to society in a way that's, you know, meaningful outside of just sort of fantasy escapism. You could say that about superhero movies, although once in a while they sort of, you know, get involved in those kinds of topics. I really like Black Panther for that reason. Black Panther's villain is the most nuanced villain I think I may have seen in any superhero, or at least conventional superhero movie, and that elevates the conversation. It changes the level at which we are giving our intelligence to it. And every movie we've seen so far, I feel like, does that. And this sounds dumb now that I hear myself saying it, but I feel like I'm figuring out why great movies are great and others are just sort of okay and exist. So when, you know, 100 years from now, they're not talking about Transformers, but they're talking about Schindler's List, maybe Deadpool, I don't know. But they'll be talking about the things that really push against type, against expectation. And it sounds obvious. I realize I'm saying a very obvious thing, but this experience with these movies has really hammered that for me in a way I didn't expect. I just kind of thought I'd get out of them whatever they're worth and I'd move on. But it's really made me think about when film has something really important to say, or at the very least wants to sort of, like I keep saying, subvert the thinking of the day and go a different direction and go against the grain a little bit. Those are the ones that stick out, that end up on these lists that people remember, that shows like us go back and watch because, you know, we're interested in why, what's the big deal. Like, that's fascinating to me for some reason.
Well, the one thing that I think you've hit on that all the movies we've watched so far do is shine a light on something that either is meant to be hidden or is accidentally hidden.
Right.
Casablanca is the one example that's sort of against the type. Casablanca was made as a pulp, you know, the Pulp Fiction of movies. It was cranked out, but it just happened to point to the zeitgeist underpinning people's feelings about World War II at the time. And it did it in a beautiful way. So it subverted in that respect. But The Godfather was shining a light on the mafia, right? Citizen Kane, shining a light on the rich moguls. Psycho, shining a light on the serial killer. Mm-hmm. And Sunset Boulevard, shining a light on Hollywood. All of them in a way that let us see a piece of these stories that we wouldn't have otherwise. Even if they're fiction, so there's a truth in them. And I think it's cool that you're having that realization, because that's what this is about. Is let's not watch them because they're old. Let's watch them because they're good, right? Or at least everyone thinks they're good, and then see if we agree.
Sure, and not only see if we agree, but just, you know, now I kind of have an eye for it. I feel like I'm looking for these threads of them taking things to different places, especially in the context of when they're released, like in 1950. You had a lot of schlocky science fiction, a lot of really cheese bag stuff going on, a lot of sloppy romantic comedy style things that probably have their place, certainly. But then you have, once in a while, you have one of these come out and you're just like, oh, okay, this is different level. This is just a little cut above what I'm used to. And at the time, it must have been pretty breathtaking. It makes me wonder if they got all these nominations. What was it, 12 total nominations or something? and won three pretty safe ones because Hollywood didn't want to be looking in that mirror. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not, I don't want to say there's a conspiracy all these years later, but we even talk about it now. I was talking to Justin earlier today about the Shape of Water. He thinks one, because it was the safest choice between two movies that are very controversial in which way they vote. So if they vote for Get Out, a lot of people assign a bunch of meaning to that. If they vote for Three Billboards, a bunch of people assign meaning to that in light of the fact that Get Out exists. Then you look at their history with horror movies, and we have this big conversation about this, but it's not that Shape of Water isn't great. It's that, that Shape of Water is just metaphorical enough that you don't have to look at yourself too hard. Do you know what I'm saying? I don't know if any of that makes sense.
But I mean, I don't want to relitigate your previous conversation with Justin Robert Young. I think it's sometimes tempting to assign motivations that aren't there because maybe they emerge out of the aggregate, right?
Right.
Every individual who cast their vote had a different reason for casting their vote. Mm-hmm. But in the aggregate, maybe that becomes true. You know, maybe there is a little worry about what it means. I think there's also a worry about what it means if I don't vote for something. A lot of times a movie like Get Out or Three Billboards will get a vote because they don't want to not be seen voting for it, right? Mm-hmm. Even if it's a private vote, mm-hmm. they want to be able to say like, no, I voted for that. So it's worth discussing all of that stuff. I don't think Sunset Boulevard necessarily suffered suppression of votes because of its underbelly, but I wouldn't be surprised if certain people said under their breath, I'm never voting for that, because they obviously used my story, obviously used my friend's story, obviously pointed out this truth. That's because it's a good movie.
Right.
Right. It pointed out that truth. And I actually think the Academy has gotten better about that over the years, about not being so knee-jerk about it. Sunset Boulevard was done at a time when you didn't do Three Billboards. You would never do Shape of Water because of the cross-species nature of the storyline. You would never, none of those stories would ever even get made. So it's kind of hard to compare.
Sure, yeah.
It is at a time when the Breen Code was very strict and they were able to slip something by, and Breen Code was very strict because a lot of people felt it was necessary. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that could rub some people the wrong way as well.
So this was the 23rd Academy Awards. That year, almost everything they didn't win went to All About Eve. Another movie I have seen. I had to watch it for college psychology, if you can believe it. It seemed like a weird thing that they were still showing people.
Number 10, by the way, All About Eve.
Oh,
we'll be watching that in a few months.
Cool. It's been a while. It's been since college for me, so I'm curious to get back into that one. But I always like to see what ends up winning. One day someone will look back and go, all right, why didn't Pulp Fiction win that year? Let's see. Oh, they gave it to Forrest Gump. What a crime.
Like, well, and for whatever reason, right, you know, whatever the reason is, and the reasons are different all the time, Best Picture Oscar winners aren't always the best pictures of all time.
No.
And a lot of that has to do with the fact that what makes movies great sometimes is longevity. Mm-hmm. Right. What one of the things that makes The Godfather great is it's a movie from 1972. And you think about movies from 1972, they always look dated. Those styles, if nothing else, just make it look dated. We like movies from the 40s and 50s because they look cool, even mm-hmm. though they look dated. Mm-hmm. 1970s does not usually look cool to people. And so it kind of, the fact that it can persist and people go, but it's so real. It doesn't look like a dated movie. It looks like a real movie of its time. That's what makes it great. It was appreciated in its time, so maybe it's not the best example of what I'm talking about, but
sure.
But movies, you know, I don't want to get too deep into this, but movies, our appreciation of them depend a lot on what we bring to them. And a movie that's old sometimes is easier to appreciate because you're not bringing in a bunch of baggage. You're not someone who works in Hollywood in 1950, right? So you don't care that, even if you work in Hollywood, you're not going to care that they shine the light under the belly of the Sunset Boulevard. You say, oh, well, it's not like that anymore. Maybe it is, but you can rationalize it, right?
Sure.
So but the other side of it is, if you can bring your modern 2018 experiences to a movie from 1950 and still see something in there, well, then that movie has really shown a light on the human condition in a way that you might not be able to tell 1950.
Chatroom keeps saying things like comes from a real place or has a thread of truth. That's what makes these things work. And I think I agree. Also, for quick correction, earlier I was struggling to remember Fatal Attraction. Yes,
Fatal Attraction. Fatal Attraction what you remember?
That's okay, the one I was thinking of. All I could think of was Cruella de Vil and she killed a rabbit. Now, that's technically true, but that's not the character she was playing in that movie. And she did kill a rabbit, though.
Yeah.
Anyway, but yeah, movies like this probably inspired those kinds of movies to be made. I don't know. I always like to try to trace a lineage back and say, all right, well, this movie I think is cool now. Who does it owe itself to? You know, like there's a million things inspired by Star Wars. There's a whole bunch of stuff inspired by Godfather. Like I like to see that because I like iteration and I think iteration's fun to sort of follow. I don't know if this movie deserves the ultimate credit for kind of a dark, crazy lady kills a dude because she won't love him enough credit or not. I don't know. But it feels like it. It feels weirdly original to me.
Gloria Swanson is so over the top that she can't not be real, right?
Yeah.
Like either this is The Room, right? Or she is like, and I've met people, and I'm sure most of folks out there too, where you're like, you can't be real.
Right.
They're rare, right? Mm-hmm. But that's what makes them stick out. And I think that's what's going on. And Holden really does provide that counterpoint where, yes, he feels of his time. We don't meet people who talk like that much anymore.
I wish we did.
He's a normal guy. And sure. And the movie does the work to get you to know that, right? Mm-hmm. He has the argument with on the lot where he's like, come on, man, I haven't sold a script in a while. I really need this. They're going to repossess my car. The whole thing starts when he's running away from the repo man. You get like, okay, this is a real down on his luck, normal guy. This is me. This is me in Hollywood. Like I would not be the super rich person, even if I want to be. This is the person I could see myself being, right? Mm-hmm. And then he meets over the top Gloria Swanson. And you're like, gosh, you know, he shouldn't do this, but I get why. He needs that money, you know?
Sure.
We have earned the right to allow him to take advantage of her because we've seen just how desperate he is.
Yeah, no, totally. There are two William Holdens.
William Holden plays Joe Gillis in Sunset Boulevard.
Who's the other guy? Hold on. Not to be confused with...
James Holden is the captain of the Rosinante in the Expanse.
That's maybe what I'm doing. I'm way too into the Expanse. I think that might be it. It's screwing me up. Anyway, I keep thinking to myself, oh, where do I know him from? What other things have I seen? And I went back and dug around a little bit and found some interesting information. I really like Network. Have you ever seen Network? That was pretty good, that movie.
Yeah, it was later in his career.
Way later, 70s. He's fantastic in that. And that was a very memorable thing. Outside of that, I don't have a lot of memory of the guy. So I started digging a little bit further, and I saw that he died about the same age as my dad, 63. And I thought, well, that's interesting. Let's see what the story is there. Had kind of a sad story. So this is the guy that was at Ronald Reagan and Nancy Reagan's wedding. So he was a big shot for a long time. People loved him. Best friend to stars and politicians and all that kind of stuff. This is how he died. And in every picture, he's got a cigarette. So I thought, it's going to be one of these Hollywood cancer lung things.
Yeah, right. Smoked all his life.
I was sure that was going to be it. Heart attack from, you know, pulmonary, this or that. Nope. He suffered a severe laceration on his forehead and bled to death after he slipped on a throw rug and hit his head on a table. Claims that he was intoxicated at the time have been disputed. That's a bummer way to go, don't you think?
So that is such of its time, even though it's a much later time, that you would dispute that he was drunk, right? Like, ooh, that would be a scandal. Like today, people would be like, yeah, man, could have been drunk, right? Like,
right.
We don't even know. Think Does about it matter?
No.
Like, that's really sad. He slipped and hit his head. Like people slip and hit their heads, whether they're drunk or not.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
And so, yeah.
Totally. Speaking of him, let's play a little clip. This is William Holden doing a line in the movie. Here you go.
I want you to do this work.
Me? I'm busy. I just finished a script and I'm doing another assignment.
I don't care.
I don't care.
Oh, yeah. And this is the part that actually hits home with me because I still hear people who work here in LA say this all the time. Like, oh yeah, never be honest. Mm-hmm. Fake it till you make it. Mm-hmm. He is following that script. Mm-hmm. Like, oh no, you know, I've got plenty of scripts. He even blusters to his friend at Paramount when he's like, you know, Fox is real interested in this, and they're not. Yeah. We know that as the viewer. So that's such an interesting development in his character where you're like, no, just be honest. And other times he's ridiculously, I mean, he's totally honest with Betty Schaefer, mm-hmm. up to a point. He mm-hmm. never actually lies to her. He just leaves out the truth.
Right. I really liked her character as well. I almost forgot to mention that we have a very young Jack Webb in this movie.
The happiest Jack Webb you'll ever see.
Ever. In fact, I couldn't figure out where he was. I see him in the credits. I'm like, oh, I'll watch for Jack Webb. I know him. He's always going, just the facts, ma'am, and he'll be real serious.
Dun,
and,
dun, dun, dun.
Yeah, he'll be very monotone and all that. No, Artie's like a freak. He's like a big old, you know, spaz monkey. In fact, here he is right here.
Stick him up, Gillis. Stick him up or I'll let you have it.
Would you believe me if I told you I stayed with a sick friend?
Someone in the formal set, no doubt, with a 10-carat kidney stone.
Oh, that stop last, Artie, will you?
That last bit's a little more Jack Webb I'm used to, but... But still,
a little bit, but it's still said with a smile, right?
Yeah, he's like, very young, very, very yeah. different than you're used to. But
I know Jack Webb is Artie Green. I know Jack Webb is in this, and I still forget that's Jack Webb the first time he comes on screen.
Very different. And look, Tom and I are neither of us are really of the generation of Jack Webb, but we watched enough Dragnet.
Watch it on reruns. Yeah.
Oh yeah, Dragnet was on every Saturday. I
binged. These are their stories.
Yeah, and it was great. And he, you know, that was one of the great stereotypes was his voice, and people still make fun of that dude all the time. And to see him in this was a real eye opener. I didn't know he did roles like this. Just completely threw me.
Well, this is very early in his career. It's one of the first roles he ever had. So it does show he could act.
Yeah,
that the Dragnet Jack Webb is definitely an act, not just the way he was.
Yeah,
because this shows that he had a pulse.
I do. Great. I do like to experiment when we talk about these movies and say whether or not we think that a movie like this could or should deserve either remake, reboot, or reimagining efforts. Like Psycho had that done to, you know, a lot of people's dismay. They didn't think it turned out very good. I actually didn't hate it. I thought the remake was okay. It just seemed kind of not needed. And that's another criteria, right?
Right.
Whether it's needed to be done or it was just, are you saying anything new or doing anything new by remaking it? I actually am on the side on this one as in the idea that this would be a pretty great remake. But the caveat for me would be still set it in the 50s, late 40s, and have it be a period piece about that time, have it still be about a silent film era actress, like carry all that stuff forward, but tell it the way we tell things now, have the kind of set direction, cinematography, technical prowess we have now, the kind of acting that we approach this sort of stuff with now. That would be interesting to me. What I don't want is a modern retelling of this story where it's some other thing like, oh, I was big until YouTube came along or some dumb idea like that. I don't want that. Like, let's go back.
Oh, my God. I was worried that you and I wouldn't have a very interesting conversation about this time because I thought you were going to say what I want, but you're pretty much saying the opposite.
What do you want?
I do not want them to redo this in its period.
Interesting.
I absolutely do not. Like, you can't find Gloria Swanson again. You can't recapture. You can't put Buster Keaton on screen again. Hmm. Do not do what Scott asks, please. Do not ever remake this in its period. What I would accept is what you're saying. You know what? Which is, I want this to be done in a modern sensibility. Find the story that fits the pattern of here's someone that was super successful in their earlier life, and then time passed them by. And they're trying to recapture that spirit. Now, I agree. It's like saying it's a movie star that can't make it on YouTube would be dumb because that's not a real scenario, right? Mm-hmm. But if you can find that big change, then yeah, I would like to tell it. That's your trick, though, is what is that story?
Right.
And if you can find that story that makes Scott change his mind, you've nailed it. But I don't know what it is.
I don't know what it is either. Maybe if they did a retelling, it'd be like maybe typecasting is the new way to look at this. In a way, that was the problem. They were typecast as silent film actors and couldn't break into talkies because it just didn't feel right. It's not like they didn't try. All those people tried to keep getting work. But turns out,
I think you have to wait for the internet to play out to remake Sunset Boulevard.
Interesting.
And then because talking movies was incredibly disruptive. We haven't had anything that disruptive. Television was gonna be, but it really didn't. Movies just adapted. It wasn't like these big movie stars suddenly couldn't get jobs. In fact, it's been the other way around. TV stars were always trying to make the transition into movies. And occasionally there was a George Clooney who did it, but it was rare. That's getting less rare now. But the internet is destroying things, right?
Yeah, it's
and
disrupting.
Maybe at some point, there's going to be one of these old categories of media. It doesn't even have to be movies, where someone could have been at the top of their game and now 15 years later, they're not.
Yeah, that's interesting. Because the internet, if you're to rate all these disruptions in modern society, I think the internet probably ranks at the top, at least so far, the best I can tell.
Well, it's not only disruptive, but it's disruptive in multiple ways, right?
Yeah.
You know, bringing sound to movies, disrupted movies.
Yeah.
That's it. It didn't disrupt photography. It didn't disrupt, anything else.
And I agree with you, the threat of TV was never quite realized, but even that threat was a threat to the movie going experience, bringing things into the home, making it convenient, no reason to go to movie theaters anymore. Like all of these, all of these little disruptions, I don't think any of it compares to what the internet is doing to everything. Everything's being disrupted. Phone service, audio, video, movies, TV, how we get anything is being disrupted by the internet. And so there's going to be a great time for that story. I don't know when that is. I don't know how far off we have to get.
It might be 15 years from now.
Sure. I hope we're still around.
But then you find that big network news anchor, or that big network star who lost it all when everyone went to the internet. Problem is, what's happening now that makes this a harder story to tell is, rather than killing TV and movies, it's just moving them to Netflix and Amazon. Right?
Oh, right. Yeah. No, that's true. I mean,
so it's bad for the executives, but they don't make as compelling of a story.
No, they don't. But it's
maybe
also
musicians, maybe like a big pop star that didn't really have any talent, can't make it anymore currently, because you can't just, throw money at the problem and make somebody a hit like you used to.
Sure. What if you did? I'm not saying this should be Shatner or use his name, but what if you could take William Shatner, who was very, very locked into who the character of Kirk was. Like, that was the definition of typecasting in a lot of ways for a very long part of his career. He's finally, he finally kind of came around to it and embraced it. But for a long time, he resented it. He hated the conventions. He hated everything about it. He did not want to be Captain Kirk forever. He wanted to do other things, and the world just wouldn't let him. Or he didn't have the breadth to do it the way Patrick Stewart or somebody else can. And I always thought about, what would that story be like if it got to a point of desperation and then he becomes like some horrible, like her.
Reactionary Twitter.
Yeah, like some horrible person. Man who does terrible things and should be serving federal time and is on the run. Like, there's a story there to be made. I'm not saying it has to be called William Shatner's story.
Yeah, I don't think that's Sunset Boulevard, though. I think you've got a whole different story going.
It's not, but you know what I'm saying? Like, have your world so turned upside down that you do a desperate, hideous thing.
Yeah.
And she's crazy, obviously. They're pushing that home that she's crazy the entire time. But there's probably a story like that to be told, and there's probably some I can't even think of right now that I've seen that are.
Well, Zilo in our chat room points out, I thought this was called BoJack Horseman. BoJack Horseman is basically a cartoon modern day Sunset Boulevard. You're right.
That's really funny. It
right?
is.
He is a big 80s TV star who can't find work anymore and is trying to make a comeback. Like, it's not far off. And it's not as disruptive as talking movies versus silent movies, but it is that same story. I hadn't even thought of that.
It is, but you know what's funny? BoJack Horseman's, it's almost like inaccurate, because we're already seeing, the other day we get a brand new trailer for our new Roseanne season. Like, all these 80s shows are getting new life on streaming services.
Yeah, the internet's actually resurrecting things that were gone versus.
I'm telling you, dude, if you and I 5 years ago were talking about this very thing, I don't think either of us were predicting that we'd get new Full House, new One Day at a Time, new Roseanne, new all
Will
across
the
board, Will and Grace. Like, any of this stuff would come back seemed like a joke. Now we're getting a new Lost in Space thing on Netflix. Just saw the trailer for that. That looks great. Like, it's weird. Everyone thought, oh, the internet's just going to take it all away. In some ways, it's giving it back.
And in some ways, I'm starting to think as we talk that maybe even the internet is not as disruptive as talking movies.
Interesting.
And maybe talking movies didn't have to be as disruptive as it was. But basically what Sunset Boulevard shows you is everyone was a superstar until suddenly they weren't.
Right.
And that's something I don't think people realize was, you know, people like Gloria Swanson, literally her, not Norma Desmond, actually Gloria Swanson, were superstars. Mm-hmm. Buster Keaton was a superstar. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly the jazz singer happens. People are like, I want to hear these actors talk. And folks are like, ooh, but their voice is awful. Well, they can't really act other than with their face. And their careers are gone. Mm-hmm. Even the internet hasn't done that. Like you say, the internet is actually spurring or directly creating the opportunity for people to, in John Goodman's case, come back from the dead.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's right. I forgot about that. Oh my gosh, I totally forgot that his character's not supposed to be alive.
Yeah.
Boy, they sure ignore that in the trailer, don't they? They just get right to it.
And maybe that's part of the Sunset Boulevard appeal is, even if you don't think it through that way, because I certainly hadn't, maybe it's that sudden demise that gives you that little bit of sympathy for Norma Desmond, mm-hmm. as crazy as she is, as awful as she is. Mm-hmm. And you know it from the minute you meet her. She's arrogant, beyond reason. You're like, yeah, but she had it all and she lost it. Mm-hmm. And what I do like about the story, and I've always liked, is it's not about the money. She didn't lose the money.
Right.
She's got that rich house. She's got all the money, but she lost everything else.
Yeah. And she'd been working since, 1914 was her first, although that's unconfirmed. So technically 1915, her first silent film. Everything in the silent film era is listed as a short. That's something I learned yesterday. Mm. I don't know why.
They didn't make them two hours long.
Yeah, they're all short by whatever standard is short now. So there's no such thing as a silent film that was a 2.5-hour movie. They just didn't make them. But 1915, she worked all the way up until 1974 with Airport 1975. Great, horrible movie. She was also in Killer Bees, the TV movie Killer Bees. Oh, I love that movie. I love it. So good. We watched it for Film Sack. I think it's the one we watched. It's fan-freaking-tastic. Anyway.
Well, and if you look, I mean, she made a decent transition, mm-hmm. but her credits stop in 1934.
Yeah,
they don't come back until the war, when it's probably like, oh, okay, cast Gloria, why not? Mm-hmm. And then Sunset Boulevard brings her back fully, and then she works pretty steadily after that.
Yeah, she did a ton after that. And she was on TV for a while, did My Three Sons for a while. She did some other cool stuff. It's nice to see, because then I was starting to look at her contemporaries, some of her peers, not so lucky. Some of those people was like 1935 and out. Like, that was all they got. They got no other opportunities. It was silent, silent, silent film all the way up till then. Super popular, and then poof.
Then gone.
Career's gone like that. So she's fascinating to me, and she lived a nice long life. She died in 83, April 4th of 83. She was 84 years old. She only died 2 years after William Holden, but he died 20 years younger than her.
That's crazy.
Isn't that
she
weird?
She outlived William Holden.
Yeah, that's really weird. Anyway, and that Eric von Strymon guy.
Von Strym.
That guy. I never say his name right. He died just 7 years later after this movie came out, so he wasn't around for very much longer. But I did that thing again, Tom, that I do with these old movies. I'm watching it, and I realize everybody in every scene doing anything doesn't exist anymore. Gone.
Yeah. Well, 1950, too, right? Like, I mean, when we watch The Godfather, that's more surprising.
Sure.
When we watch Casablanca or when we get to start watching some movies from the 30s, it's going to be less surprising.
Yeah.
But 1950, you're like, gosh, kind of feel like maybe they should still be around.
Somebody. Yeah. But every scene, cops running around checking the pool, house full of people for the card game. Nobody exists. Those sets are
little
empty.
Little girl in the seltzer shop.
Right.
It's not seltzer shop. What is it called?
The writer, the director, Billy Wilder, doesn't exist. They just don't exist anymore. And I don't know why I find that haunting. I just always have.
Like, cuz you see dead people.
I guess like the Casablanca one is the most hard hitting for me, cuz there was a scene where that place is packed. Just packed with people milling around, partying, playing piano, dancing, singing, drinking. If you could just make a shot of that place right now, poof, nobody's there. There's not even a guy behind the camera. That's how dead everyone is. It's really weird to me.
Well, but they live on in cinema.
Oh, that's right. Their celluloid lives go on.
Yeah. That's why we're doing so many podcasts, folks.
That's right. Now, this
one of them will one day be considered a classic.
This was what on our list? What number was it?
We're into number 5 on the list. And if people haven't heard this part yet, real quickly, the list is not a definitive list of our opinion. It's created by averaging the rankings from Rotten Tomatoes Top 100 as of May 17th last year, IMDb ratings on the same day, and the American Film Institute Top 100. Films mentioned on only 2 of the lists had 101 points added to the score for weighting. Films that only appeared on one list had 152 points added for weighting. But otherwise, it was just a weighting across of the scores across so that we could come up with this list. So the higher they were on the list, the fewer points they had. So when I say they added 152 points, you'd be like, why would you do that? It's the more points you have, the lower on the list you are. So if you're number 1 on all 3 lists, you would have had 3 points. The Godfather had 14 points. Right. That was the number 1.
So for the month of April, we'll be dumping into number 6 on these average lists, and that happens to be The Wizard of Oz. So we're getting some color all up in here.
Oldest movie we've seen so far, and yet, half the movie's in color.
Yeah, which is
crazy. We've only seen The Godfather in color so far.
And it has been, I mean, as much as I saw Wizard of Oz as a kid, it was kind of required viewing all the time. I haven't seen it in ages and ages and ages. There is so much cool periphery about that movie. Like, watch it in time with the entirety of Dark Side of the Moon.
The sync up.
Is there a little person hanging in the back scene who committed suicide on set? No one knew. Like, lots of weird, Snopey kind of things about it.
Lots of things that aren't true.
Right, lots of untruths. That's true. But there's so many urban legends that it fascinates me that movie has so many. Plus,
well,
it's just
it became one of those broadcast television events in its later life. I remember watching it because every year it would come on broadcast television and my mom would gather us around and we'd have special snacks and we'd watch The Wizard of Oz.
Yeah, I'm excited about this one. So early next April, that's what we're doing. We do these once a month now and we're totally enjoying them.
You know, one last thing about Sunset Boulevard before we wrap up. Yep. I wanted to ask you what you thought of the scene where Joe hits on Betty Schaefer after our dear friend Jack Webb, Artie Green tells him, like, hey, don't steal my girl. Like, it's the one time that I suddenly was like, oh, maybe Joe isn't a sympathetic character. Maybe Joe deserves all of this because he's very clearly, like, goes from, hey, Artie, help me out, to let me hit on your girl.
It was a little skeevy, for sure.
It was real skeevy.
Yeah.
And I think it was even skeevy for 1950.
I agree. And her reaction was a little skeevy. Like, there was definitely a, hey, sorry, Artie, go in the other room. We may have found a new relationship here we don't want you to be aware of. Like, there was a little, that felt subversive and shocking for its era.
Yeah.
I agree with you.
She wanted to spend time with him because she admired his intellect, she admired his writing, and she wanted to write with him. So that kind of feels like, oh, and maybe she's unsure about her feelings with Artie. And like that part played a little better for me than him very clearly, like, this is your buddy, man. This is your friend. You're asking him favors, and then you go right in to like not just flirting, but like full on leaning in. Mm-hmm. Like, ugh.
Well, yeah. No, it gave me that feeling I get with movies like, oh, another good one. It's not so much a good movie as it is another example of this sort of woman spurned, kill the guy, create havoc or whatever. But Single White Female from back in 90 something reminds me of this a lot. And there's a feeling that you get when you're like, oh, no. If you do that, this starts a whole big ball of wax rolling down the hill. And old lady weirdo back at the house is going to start getting weird. And turns out she starts phone calling what's her name and kind of harassing her. And then you know things are going to go real bad. It was that moment with that relationship at that party where I went, you guys, freaking.
It makes me wonder, would the story be hurt if you didn't have Betty B. Artie's girlfriend?
Right.
Right?
Right.
But you kind of need him to push her towards Artie. Like at the end, he somewhat redeems himself, although it's selfish, when he says, you should go marry Artie.
Right.
Although Betty's, I feel like if I were Betty's friend, I'd be like, you shouldn't marry either one of them. You obviously don't care enough about Artie to marry him. Don't make a mistake and lock yourself up. Yeah. But Joe obviously has issues. Don't go for him either. You can do better, girl.
Yeah. I'm picturing you saying that to your television as you were watching this. Anyway, it's fantastic. People should watch it. It's old as hell, but I think worth seeing, and makes the fifth spot on our list. Again, next month, it'll be The Wizard of Oz. Next week, normal episode. It's a normal current geek episode. Catch you up on the latest and greatest in geek news and having our little commentary and fun. So come on
back
for
that. Get in that subreddit. Submit some stories for us.
Yes, please.
Hope you're not out of practice. Yeah. Apologize.
Yeah, no worries. Real quick here, I got an email. Speaking of stuff we've been doing lately, this is nice to receive. It came to us at currentgeek@gmail.com. This is from somebody named Paul France, who says, it's a great name, by the way, says, loved your episode about Lost and the pilot. Forgot how much I enjoyed Autopilot, and this brought it all back. Excited for more. Well, good news is we're going to do more of those as well. So as part of our little shakeup.
I'm going to try to see if I can find it real quick, but there was someone on Twitter went and found Autopilot episode 12.
Oh, my Lord.
That we did about Lost.
Oh, did we do one about Lost?
And then listened to our current geek and was like, you guys say a lot of the same things and come to a lot of the same conclusions.
I didn't know we did Lost in the first place.
I had forgotten we did it too.
What? That doesn't sound right. Are we sure that guy's right? Have we done Lost?
That seems
nuts to me. I don't remember doing it like at all. I have no memory of that. That's nuts. All right. Well, I guess maybe we did.
Yeah.
It's good to know we came to some of the same conclusions then, right?
Yeah. I feel like this is the largest version of you telling a story twice and no one pointing it out because they're like, yeah, it's fine. Grandpa tells the same story twice all the time.
Yeah, I was going to say this is a grandpa thing. We're in our favorite chair and we forgot we told you before. Well, anyway, thank you for that, Paul. And there is more coming. No news on what that next one is, but we're going to try to do one of those a month as well. But normal episode next week. Can't wait for that. It's going to be great. Stick around for the end of the show for a talk from the Legal Geek on how an embedded tweet may lead Supreme Court litigation. It's all based on a copyright case from New York. I love his segments. So if you're into that stuff, check it out. That's Legal Geek coming up right after this. Tom Merritt, before we go, anything you'd like to mention or say?
You know what? If you like Star Wars, I know some of you do. Yeah. We have a show called Let's Talk About Star Wars that I do with Garrett Weinzierl and Jenny Josephson, where we talk about Star Wars. And we just this morning recorded an episode reviewing the Star Wars Rebels finale, as well as thoughts on the entire season of Star Wars Rebels this year. So if you have just watched the finale last night and you're like, I need to talk to somebody about it, here's your chance. Let's talk about StarWars.com.
Okay. Give me just a quick grade. The entirety of the series, pleased with it? I still have never seen an episode. That makes me lame, I know. So I'm going to go watch it. I'm going to finally binge on that thing. But was that a good package of Star Wars? And are you happy you saw it?
Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely. Without reservation. It starts good. With some weaknesses and just gets better and better.
I like that. The sound of that is good sound to me. And happy with the finale, ended the way you'd like it to?
Yeah, that you'll have to listen to the episode. That's a very complex question to answer.
All right. Well,
but
check
mostly
that out.
Happy.
Remind me the URL again. Let's talk about StarWars.com.
Let's talk about StarWars.com.
Can't believe that wasn't taken. That's insane. Don't forget, you can support us on our Patreon, patreon.com/currentgeek. That's patreon.com/currentgeek. I just finished the latest membership cards. Those are going out to that level ASAP, and I'm very proud of that one. So check for that in your mail coming soon for those who are there. And if you haven't supported us, consider it. It's a fantastic thing to do. That's patreon.com/TMS. You can call us and leave us a voicemail. Oh,
TMS?
Did I say TMS? Current Geek.
Yeah,
gosh dang it. Memory.
Did Ribbit pay you to do that?
No. He's probably laughing his head off, though, right now that I did that. Sorry. Patreon.com/CurrentGeek. Current Geek on Twitter. Scott Johnson. Ace Detect. Oh, what else? CurrentGeek.reddit.com if you'd like to submit some stories for our next episode. And again, CurrentGeek.com is the website for everything else. Going to do it for me, for Tom, and for all of you. We'll see you next time.
All right, Mr. Johnson.
Hold up. This week we cover a recent case from New York about embedding tweets into news articles that may lead to a circuit split of opinion and Supreme Court litigation on what constitutes copyright infringement. Who knew that embedding a tweet could have such dire consequences? The case is entitled Goldman v. Breitbart News Network, and it was decided in late February at a New York federal district court. Justin Goldman is a photographer who captured an image of Tom Brady speaking with Boston Celtics GM Danny Ainge in July 2016, and he then posted it on Snapchat. This photo went viral and was shared in many other platforms like Twitter. That also led to a slew of news articles with speculation of how Brady and Ainge might be working together. These news articles came from sources such as Yahoo, Time, Gannett, and the Boston Globe, with many of these articles embedding tweets of other Twitter users containing Goldman's photo. Goldman filed suit and claimed such a practice was copyright infringement of his photograph. Embedding tweets works by displaying the content of another server or site, in this case Twitter, in the middle of a news article when published online. Thus, the news publishers never stored a copy of the picture on their servers, and this was argued by the news companies as decisive proof that there was no copyright infringement. This theory is based on a Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals case called Perfect 10 v. Amazon, which occurred in California. In that case, Google was being sued for copyright infringement for showing nude or suggestive images, originally from the Perfect 10 magazine, when Google image searches led to sites having this content. That case drew an interesting distinction between the showing of thumbnails in the initial search and the full-size images shown when a user would click on a corresponding thumbnail. The full-size images were shown by InSight linking to the other sources, while the thumbnails were stored on Google's server, and this storage was deemed to make the thumbnails copyright infringement. In other words, linking or embedding an image from another source and displaying it is not a prohibited display of a copyrighted work because it was never stored on the server of the infringer. The New York court explicitly questioned whether the Perfect 10 decision was correct in concluding the opposite in this case. The copyright infringement exists when embedding tweets with images, even though there is no local storage of that image by the news sites. Thus, the photographer wins at this level, although you can likely expect this to be appealed by the big publishers to the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, and then to the Supreme Court if they don't win at the intermediate level. If this occurs, this is precisely the type of split in law or interpretation between regional circuit courts that usually leads to the Supreme Court taking a case and rendering a decision, so embedding a tweet could lead all the way to the Supreme Court. Most social networks' terms of service force you to sign away such IP rights claims against them, but this waiver interestingly does not stretch to those who repeat content from those social networks, at least in the judgment of this court. Just another fascinating quirk of this case. The bottom line is, the lines of what constitute copyright infringement can be ever-changing in the field of online publishing, and that's even when there's no fair use claim. Sometimes the most seemingly innocuous action can lead to the highest courts, and we will keep our eyes on this possibility in this case. Thanks for listening. Please provide feedback and segment suggestions to me on Twitter at BuckeyeFitzy.
This show is part of the Frog Pants Network.
Frog Pants Network.
Get more shows like this at frogpants.com.